Welcome to the final serious TV drama podcast of 2021. I'm Scott, and joining me tonight, it's just me. I was almost going to invite Mason Verger to sit in with me. I know he had some choice lines he was going to riff on, but after ending the year dealing with the COVID and all, I didn't know if I had the strength to deal with that monkey ass mouth Yosemite Sam in a wheelchair. So it's just going to be me tonight. So I'm going to call this podcast Taking a Bite Out of Apple TV. I almost was going to put my name in the title, but I decided, hey, you know what? That's a little much and would likely frighten off, you know, the few listeners we do hope to wrangle for this one. So let's get on with this. Now, like many folks, I had taken advantage of one of those deals. So when you update your iPhone, where you then get a free trial run of Apple TV. Now, unfortunately, I actually missed the cutoff to get a full year's worth. I missed it by like 3 weeks, I think. But I was still entitled to get 3 months free Apple TV. But life got busy and weird throughout the summer and early fall for me. Dealt with a few different crises and such. And, you know, then got busy with yet another project that took up a lot of my spare time. So even though I got this iPhone back in July, I didn't activate the free Apple TV trial until, geez, I think late October. And at that point, I decided to knock out the second season of Ted Lasso because I had already actually seen the first season while I was hanging out at my friend's house, cat-sitting a couple months earlier. And it was around that time the thought occurred to me, actually, it didn't occur to me then, I think it was later, let's say early December, I guess it occurred to me, that, you know, I should start checking out all these other series that are on Apple TV. You know, I only got the free thing till late January, but better than that, there could be podcast fodder here. And then I got hit with that COVID, which meant, guess what? I had even more potential viewing time to spend with the Apple TV. I mean, hell, I even watched the Tom Hanks World War II movie from 2020, which was both surprisingly short and really not bad at all. Almost could have been a lost episode of Band of Brothers set on the high seas or something. I also watched a somewhat disturbing new Peanuts cartoon special for the new year. Seriously, it was a really strange special, basically about Lucy Van Pelt getting depressed that her grandma decided not to visit her for the holidays. Therefore, no one in town loves her. And yeah, I don't know what the hell that was all about. Anyway, back to Apple TV and the focus of this podcast. I ended up settling on watching 7 different Apple TV series. Obviously, that's not all they offer. But, you know, I can only watch so much. But I felt, you know, maybe outside of perhaps Foundation, the series based on the Isaac Asimov stories that I just didn't have time to get to, I feel I'm going to be touching on probably the most notable of the actual series offerings for Apple TV. Plus, hey, did you hear what I said? 7 freaking series I'm going to be doing here, man. Who does that? You know, me. I do. That's who. That's you. I do that. So with each one, I do. How should I do this? I'll try to alert you guys, you know, the listeners, when I'm going to get into any discussion that involves spoilers, which is going to be the case with all 7 series here. That way, my thinking here is if you're interested in checking out one of these or any of these, but you don't want to be spoiled, you can consult the segment breakdown that I add to the podcast description. You know, you can see that. I don't care where you're downloading the podcast from. It's going to be everywhere. And you can just skip to the next chapter of interest. Although I will tell you, the way my mind works, probably the more interesting thoughts, the final summation, my opinion, my rating, whatever you want to call it, are going to tend to be in that back half of each TV series segment. So you skip the spoilers, you probably skip the good stuff. But it's up to you. If you don't want to get spoiled, you might want to check one of these things out. You can skip ahead to avoid those things, which probably means the entire podcast will be like 12 minutes for you or something. I don't know. All right. With all that said, you've heard enough of me rambling beforehand. Let's get to the real good rambling when I'm talking about the actual TV shows. And I'm going to discuss all these in the order that I watched them, which means, therefore, I have to kick everything off with probably the most talked about series of the lot, and that's Ted Lasso. Now, I was thinking about this. Every time a different streaming service came into being, as far as having original continuing series, they always had to have at least that one, maybe even two, that had to give them credibility, had to put them on the map, give them something to promote beyond whatever archive of movies they might have access to. So, you know, you go back, obviously the first player was Netflix, and I think it was Orange is the New Black and House of Cards, kind of the combination of those two were the first two big series that Netflix had that really made them stand out. Hulu, it was probably Handmaid's Tale would be the first one that really comes to mind for them. Amazon Prime is a little bit more complicated. I'm thinking probably Fleabag and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel are most likely put them out there more so than something like Bosch or The Expanse. And they go back further than, say, The Boys does now. One of the most obvious ones of all is Disney Plus and The Mandalorian. That was their flagship series. It still is, even beyond all the MCU offerings. So now we have Apple TV. Now, Apple TV started as a streaming service in November of 2019, and they kicked off November 2019 with two possible flagship series. One show that was headlined by some truly major A-list talent, and the other one, let's say, was a very high concept kind of a series. You know, the kind that makes you go, ooh, I want to check that out kind of a show. And you know what? I'm going to be talking about both of those shows soon enough. But Apple TV really put their plant, they really planted their flag in the ground in 2020 with a far more unlikely candidate than those two. A show that the premise, well, you know what? Let's be honest. It sounded a little stale. Kind of like a dumb or boring idea from decades ago. I mean, oh boy, an American football coach decides to move to England and coach a British soccer team. God, I'd rather watch Air Bud than watch something that sounded like that. Oh, wait, the twist is the owner wants the coach to fail? So basically it's the plot of Major League? Ugh. Oh, no, but we're gonna get a former SNL cast member to headline. Ooh, that could be something. Oh, wait, a guy who's been in a few movies but nothing all that memorable? So what are we talking, Rob Schneider here or something? Oh, no. Oh, God, the guy who was married to Olivia Wilde, the chick who dumped him for Harry Styles? That guy, the Sudoku, whatever his name is, I'm just going to be depressed watching the show now. Seriously, the fact that the powers that be at Apple TV went along with this pitch is already kind of shocking. And I don't believe there's any way they could have possibly foreseen how this would end up being the it show, not just for Apple TV, but pretty much one of those pop culture zeitgeist kind of lightning bolts that just doesn't come along all that often. And Jason Sudeikis, yeah, I knew what his name was. Excuse my stupid shtick earlier. He is more than just impressive in the title role. And he actually gets better from one season to the next as we chip away at the veneer and the facade that he had constructed as the affable and always seemingly positive Ted Lasso. Now, he's surrounded by a fine cast of mostly British actors. You know, you got your Brett Goldstein as the aging football legend Roy Kent, Hannah Waddingham as the teen owner Rebecca Welton, Phil Dunster as the initially arrogant budding superstar Jamie Tart, and Juno Temple as Keeley Jones, the cheeky model slash entrepreneur who, she's involved with at least one of the aforementioned football players. And the fact is, Sudeikis is a creative force behind this series, along with Bill Lawrence, who will always have a place in my heart as he was the dude behind Scrubs. Yay, Scrubs. You know, I think JD and Ted Lasso would have gotten along really well, you know? Now, as I said at the top, this is a series that's probably been talked about ad nauseum for months and months on hundreds of other podcasts and articles and everything else. So I don't actually want to spend too much time on it because I'm figuring you're just going to hear a lot of stuff you've already heard before. But I will say from this point on, I feel I need to mention certain specific plot points in episodes. So this would be the quote-unquote spoiler section. So if you haven't seen Ted Lasso yet, and I find that hard to believe, you don't want to get spoiled on anything, skip this part and move on to the next chapter. So where the series really takes a turn, and I would say probably a turn for the dramatic and perhaps that therefore better, is during the course of season two, where we really get to experience Ted's panic attacks and his resulting depression. And a lot of this is through his scenes with the Dr. Sharon character. I love the dynamic between him and the team psychiatrist. I think that's actually one of the strongest things about season two. And that's a very strong season beyond that. Obviously, if one is paying close enough attention, you can see hints of this throughout season one, but season two is where it all really starts to manifest for his character. It's just something that makes you appreciate a lot of the work Sudeikis put into this character, undoubtedly doing research on the topic as well as just really inhabiting the role. So very impressive stuff. What else? Well, season two does have that one somewhat polarizing episode. So let me just deal with that right now. It's the Beard After Hours episode, which focuses primarily on Coach Beard, and it's pretty much kind of like a riff on the early 80s Scorsese movie After Hours. It's very similar to that in structure, where it's just an all-night situation with Coach Beard as he roams around town from misadventure to misadventure that gets bizarre and weirder as the evening draws on. I don't know what everyone's problem is with this. Is it because it's not a major plot-forwarding episode the way the rest of the season before and after was? I suppose you could be that way about it, but that really shouldn't matter. And it is connected to everything, and there is a bit of plot progression both at the beginning and the end of the episode. Plus, Coach Beard is one of the most intriguing characters on the entire show. I don't get it. If it was just annoying and not entertaining, I could understand people being upset with it, but it's both. It's fun. And it's not like you had to wait a year for the next episode. So people who got upset with this, they fall into the category of you need to get a life, people. Okay. So let's get back to one of those major plot lines of season two now. That would be the Rebecca and Sam situation. And I don't mean Cheers either. I applaud them doing this. I love the fact that the racial aspect of it never enters the situation at all. It's not even a thought. The thing that might have troubled me about it, and I can see that Rebecca was aware of it at times, but I felt she should have really been out ahead of this from the get-go, and maybe Keeley should not have been encouraging this. You're still dealing with, you know, a boss-employee situation, and a very extreme one at that. So that kind of made that whole relationship a little bit more uncomfortable and awkward for me to watch. And that was the only thing that bothered me about it. Because we're dealing with two very smart people, and they should realize the problems that could ensue if they were found out. What would happen if the press got a hold of that story? Good Lord. I mean, think about it. But they're so likable, you kind of want to root for them anyway, despite the fact it's such a bad idea. And speaking of things of people that maybe at one point you rooted for, even though by the time we go through the second season, most people weren't. Talk about a guy with bad ideas. Let's talk about the rise and fall of Nathan, the character played by Nick Muhammad. It's interesting the transformation we see this character undergo and how at times it's understandable and at times you just can't understand what he's doing. I mean, he's someone who suffered from various insecurities and self-esteem issues, and rightly so when the show started. I mean, this is a guy who was basically being tortured by people like Jamie Tart and other members of the team. And given no respect, no credence, no nothing when it all starts. But he did get to a certain position and he was treated better than well. He was treated with the utmost respect by his peers and even by the team. So there is a point where he kind of starts to crack. And he starts seeing things in an increasingly more irrational manner, where he starts becoming consumed with the idea that he's not getting proper credit for things. And it just becomes more and more unseemly as it goes on. You know, you kind of root for him in that episode where he wants to, you know, have his parents out for dinner at the restaurant where they first met for their anniversary and the way he's being treated there. But then we contrast that to, you know, whatever number of episodes later when, especially when it's revealed that he spilled the beans about Ted's, issues to a reporter, which just goes beyond the pale. It's just a horrible thing to have done. And by the end of the season, we discover he's actually left the team and he's going to be coaching Rupert's new team, the West Ham United, which is an actual team. Actually, I read somewhere that Seth Meyers owns a controlling part of that team or something like that. Anyway. So it's interesting how someone who was the heroic underdog by the end of the second season becomes probably the biggest villain on the show. It's also interesting if you watch his character, how his hair starts to go more and more gray as his character becomes more and more, well, dark, so to speak. You know, the hair doesn't reflect it. So by the time we see the brief shot of him being the coach for the other soccer team, I think he's gone all gray at that point. So that was kind of a fun little physical manifestation of his issues, I guess. So I think I'll wrap it up on Ted Lasso there, but now I'll give you my little rating system. I'm going to rip off this film critic who used to be on this channel in New York, New York One. It's still here. It's called Spectrum One now, but you know, we all call it New York One still. It'll always be New York One. I forget the critic's name. I think it was like Neil Hurwitz or something like that. Whatever. But he used, you know, because he was a New York critic, so he used Apple's. Duh. Which is what I'll do because it's Apple TV and I don't have much of an imagination. So season one, I'm going to give 4 apples to. That's 4 out of 5 apples. That's pretty much almost as high as I'm going to go with any rating I'm going to give anything in this podcast, except for the second season. Because I feel that as we got more into Coach Lasso's psyche, and they really raised the bar, I need to up the grade. So, you know what? I'm actually giving season 2 4.5 apples. All right, let us move on to the next show that I watched, and that would be The Morning Show. Now, this is a show that starred people like Jennifer Aniston as Morning Show anchor Alex Levy. Reese Witherspoon was Bradley Jackson. And then you also had Mark Duplass as Chip Black, Billy Crudup as Corey Ellison, and of course, Steve Carell as the infamous Mitch Kessler. Now, this was a show, the creators, it should be noted, the creators were Jay Carson, who came from House of Cards, and the other creator was Kerry Ehrin, who, good Lord, this person's been knocking around major TV series for over 35 years, from writing and producing work on Moonlighting all the way to doing likewise on shows like Friday Night Lights and Bates Motel. Now, the premise of the show, in case you don't already know that, they're basically riffing on like the Charlie Rose and the Matt Lauer incidents that happened on two of the three broadcast network morning shows. And as we learn in the opening minutes of the morning show, something along those lines has happened on this network's morning show. And it was Steve Carell's Mitch Kessler who was guilty of various instances of sexual misconduct, harassment, and so on. And as a result, you have Jennifer Aniston, who playing Alex Levy, who had been his on-screen partner. And at some point, they bring on the Reese Witherspoon character, who is this outspoken, small-town TV reporter who somehow ends up being her co-host. I know how, I'm just not spoiling it here, because that would be a spoiler, and that's not really relevant to my conversation. What I can say about the show in this non-spoilery fashion, although I feel they do telegraph certain major plot twists, which I won't say, I would say the first season is very strong. It might even be a fantastic season. First season, it's epic. I would highly recommend the first season. The second season, however, I do think suffers from a number of proverbial sophomore slump issues. They made some questionable decisions in the second season. So obviously there's no way I can talk about either of these things without getting into the necessary details. So once again, let's enter the spoiler zone for the rest of this segment. Now, okay, since now I can talk about it a little bit more directly. Yeah, the first season, as I said, it's extremely strong. I mean, it's a perfect bit of casting having Steve Carell play the Charlie Rose, Matt Lauer-like character, because Steve Carell is inherently a likable actor. We've known him from things like The Office and The Daily Show and The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Anchorman and various other things over the years. We instinctively like Steve Carell. And to have him play a character that's someone that the country has loved and trusted for the previous 15 years, and that's ripped apart when we discover, oh, he's kind of a scumbag. He's been doing and has done these really pretty horrible things. And as we learn about them throughout the course of the season, and I love how they initially take the stance, and it makes you kind of question some of the Me Too kind of stuff that's happened over the years, until you start to find out more. And more. And then, you know, there's no forgiving what he's done. There's no going back from it. He's just not a good guy. He's a bad guy. It's the dynamic between Aniston and Witherspoon works really nicely. Billy Crudup, far different than I've ever seen him before. I believe he actually won the Emmy for his role in the first season of Morning Show. And deservedly so. I've always kind of found him to be kind of a stiff and not really much fun to watch. And he's anything but that on this show. He's kind of like the opposite of how I always imagined Billy Crudup. So kudos to him for totally breaking type. Mark Duplass, kind of playing type. You know, he's basically this is essentially the role he usually plays. It's just sometimes he's more in control than others. Sometimes he is the smartest guy in the room. Sometimes not so much, but it's kind of what you expect out of him. But like I said, first season, very, very good. Excellent first season. Second season, however, I don't know. There's some really good stuff in it. It's not a bad season. I mean, the way they actually handle the COVID crisis, especially in the early episodes, it's very clever. It's very smart. You got to keep your eyes open and ears open for a few little details that are dropped during the very first episode of the season. And then the way that even at the very last shot, which takes place, is supposed to be, in Times Square when after the ball drops and it's 2020, and the way they zoom in on the close up of the numbers 2020 and the way the ball looks and all the glitter and whatever in the air, it looks like an illness. It looks like an airborne virus. It's very funny. It's very smart. So they do some stuff which I really like in season two, but they also do some stuff I don't like. Steve Carell's character played a very important part in season one. You needed to have him in there as much as possible. But once that season was done, he either should not have been on the show anymore in season two, or minimized to maybe only appearing in one or two episodes. And they have this entire storyline with him where he's kind of run off to Italy. And I don't even want to get into it. It's just everything that happens there is just weird and questionable. And let's just fast forward to towards the end of the season where he's just unceremoniously killed off. And I'm like, wait, what? What just happened? He ran off the road? What? I mean, it's like a bad soap opera decision. It's like, okay, we got to get rid of you now. We'll just do this. Bye. It's handled really poorly. And I think it's just some bad decision making. The entire storyline just does not work. And connected to it ends up being Alex Levy, because she runs off to Italy to see him, and somehow she's able to get back, even though they're already in lockdown there because of COVID. So that, I never really quite buy how easily she was able to get out of Italy, and so on and so forth. I don't know. It's just, there's other issues that feel a little bit repetitive during the season. They bring in Juliana Margulies, which normally I'd be like, oh, wow, you got Juliana Margulies. Love, you know, I'm a big fan of The Good Wife. But I never believed the storyline with her. I don't. It felt forced to me. It felt like, okay, we need to make a statement about this, so we're going to do this now. And I'm like, really? Really? So at the end of the day, if I'm rating the two seasons, that first season, I told you, I loved it. I'll give that first season 4 apples. But season two, I'm going to have to knock that one down a bit. I'm going to knock that one all the way down to 2.5 apples. And the more I say it out loud, the more I feel like an idiot talking about apples, but whatever. I started with that. I'm going to have to stick with it for now, I guess. So that brings us to our third series, and that would be For All Mankind. A really solid cast. Some names you might know, some names you might have to look up. I mean, your lead role is Joel Kinnaman, who plays astronaut Edward Baldwin. Joel Kinnaman, you guys remember him from things like The Killing. He's in that really weird remake of RoboCop. Very good actor. I've liked him in a lot of things. He actually read one of my scripts years ago. Anyway, who else is in it? Michael Dorman is Gordo Stevens, another astronaut. Most of these people are either astronauts or astronaut wives or whatever. Chantel Van Santen is Karen Baldwin. Sarah Jones plays Tracy Stevens. She's really great on the show. And you might remember her if you ever caught that series years ago, Alcatraz. Remember the one with Sam Neill and, I think, isn't Jorge Garcia in that one too, if I'm not mistaken? There are several other standouts in the cast, such as Jodie Balfour as Ellen Waverly, Sonia Walger as Molly Cobb. Oh, see another Lost reference I'm making here. She played Penny from Lost, y'all. And Ren Schmidt, who I feel like I've seen her before. I didn't even look her up on IMDb, but I really like her as Margot Madison. What's really important about this show are the creators. Your creators. First of all, you got Ronald D. Moore. Who's Ronald D. Moore? You all know who Ronald D. Moore is. He's the guy behind the reboot of Battlestar Galactica. He was a major producer and writer for both Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Star Trek The Next Generation. I mean, like, there isn't anyone who has probably more sci-fi related cred in the business than Ronald D. Moore. And he really writes characters and situations probably better than most, if not all. Who else? The other two co-creators are Ben Nadivi and Matt Walpert. You're like, who the heck are those guys? Hey, you know who they are? Both of these gentlemen, they both wrote and produced numerous episodes of shows like Fargo and The Umbrella Academy. You don't get too much better than that. All right, so what is For All Mankind about? I'll give you the setup. Okay, it's not as extreme an alternate reality as something like, say, The Man in the High Castle. The idea here is basically the Russians beat the United States to the moon. You know, so they won the initial space race, but no, the space race just kept on going and going and going. It continues for years. And this is how history and everyone's lives change in so many ways as a result of that. Now, there are elements in this series, you know, it feels a little bit like the Mad Men here. It feels a little bit like the Americans there. There's a lot to say that's extraordinarily positive about the show. But I will confess something to you right now. It took a little longer than I expected for me to warm up to this series. I thought I would be taken with it from the word go. But you got to realize there's a lot of setting up to do of characters and plot lines that you do realize are going to stretch out over the course of time. But I would say it probably takes until maybe the third, maybe even fourth episode of season one when this series really kicks into gear. And then you're going to get really hooked into what's going on. Now, I feel, once again, I'm probably going to say this for every one of these shows, I can't really say too much without spoiling stuff, so let's leave this protective bubble of no spoilers and get a little bit more detail specific about Bud Stevens and how I did come to not just like, but borderline love this series. Right on the borderline. Okay, so first of all, once women become part of the space program, that's when this series really finds its footing, and it really takes off from there. And that, I think that happens, starts happening like in the third episode. So it's not too long a wait. And it's not that the first two episodes are bad. They are not bad, but I think you just become more emotionally invested in the show from the third episode on. And that's important for any series, quite frankly. Because the further this series progresses, the more you're going to get invested in them, the more you're going to learn about these characters and how they're flawed, sometimes deeply. And that makes you appreciate the work the actors and the writers are putting in more so from episode to episode. Now, since I keep saying episode, there are some really standout episodes in season one, really. I mean, every episode from like the fifth one on stands out. From the initial lunar mission, where they have to try to find ice on the lunar surface, to the episode which is literally titled Hi Bob, where a trio who are, they're not marooned on the moon, but they're there for quite some time, and they have to watch the same episodes of the Bob Newhart show over and over. It's a lovely idea. It's really just a fantastic season. And it got to a point where it became, ooh, this is what binging is about, because I have to watch the next one. And that wasn't the way I felt with the first couple episodes. One thing I really love that both seasons one and two do is they clue us in during the final credits music that we are about to be in store for a major time jump. So let me explain. Season one, obviously, it starts off in 1969, and I think it's supposed to go on until, Jesus, I'm trying to remember now because they have the election. I think it goes on to like 1974, I want to say. Maybe it goes on a little bit later than that. I could be wrong. Let's hope I'm right, and I'll say 74. But when they go to the end credits, and they will use, They will license whatever music they need for this show. Their budget seems to be rather unlimited. You know, thank you, Apple. The end credit song that they play is Everybody Wants to Rule the World, the Tears for Fears song. Now, that song came out in 1985. But then we get a post-credit scene, and we can see, because it says right on the bottom of the screen, that they've jumped to 1983. So they're a little bit off with their music selection there, but, you know, we'll give them a break for that. Now, the second season, that takes place, if I'm not mistaken, once again, my impression is it takes place mostly over the course of a single year, and that would be 1983. I mean, I could be wrong. Maybe they moved into 1984, but I feel there were certain news events that they don't mention, so maybe it didn't. I don't think it did. I could be wrong. I apologize if I am. The end credits for that second season finale, it's Nirvana's Come As You Are. Now, that came out, well, the album came out in 1991, but the single, I think, was released in 1992, but, you know, you get the idea. But then when we see the post-credit moment, which is actually, you know, big spoiler, peak of somebody on Mars, it's set in 1995. So again, they didn't do the best job of matching up the music to the year, but again, not that big a deal. I mean, if that's my biggest gripe, it's not a gripe at all. But back to season two, since I mentioned it now. Once again, like season one, some terrific episodes and storylines. I really love how they handle the situation with the Ellen Waverly character, who is actually a lesbian, and there's very plausible reasons why she has to hide that about herself, and how that plays out through the course of the season is rather fascinating, actually. One, however, might take pause with the business of people shooting guns on the moon. I mean, seeing astronauts or soldiers in full astronaut gear doing that kind of semi-slow-mo gravity-less walk on the lunar surface holding these big, dumbass automatic weapons is a bit of a jarring sight. And it could have played as being dumb as fuck, let's be honest. Somehow, it kind of works. And you know, with this country of ours, it's not really as far-fetched as I'd like to think it would be. And towards the end of second season, what Gordo and Tracy do to save the lunar base is totally batshit crazy insane. But it's saving grace is how it all ultimately turns out. Now, I know this is the spoiler section, and I can actually just say it, but I'm going to go on the assumption, if you've listened to this, you may still be, and you haven't watched it, you might still be considering checking the series out. I don't want to spoil everything. I'm just going to tell you what they do is batshit crazy. When you see it, you'll know what I mean. All right, so let me finish up here. Let's get to those ratings, because holy frijoles, I still have four more series to discuss on this podcast. So season one, I'm going to give it 4 apples because it's just really that good. Now season two, I'm thinking 3.5 apples. I mean, I could stick at 4. I can't decide if some of those crazy moon shenanigans were a little too far-fetched. Or maybe I shouldn't deduct because they had the balls to be risky, knowing it could come off incredibly dumb, but it actually wasn't. You know, okay, fuck it. I talked myself into it. I'll give season two of 4 apples as well. If it's not the best show I've watched on Apple TV, it's one of the two best I've watched, or three. Because now we're getting to the next show, which I had almost forgotten about, and that show is called Mythic Quest. And I keep wanting to call it Mystic Quest. I don't know why, but it's Mythic Quest. Either way, it's not a great show for someone who has a lisp, so there you go. Now, Rob McElhenney is the creator of video game Mythic Quest. He plays the character Ian, spelled Ian, but pronounced Ian. An actress who I had not seen before. I hope I don't mispronounce her last name, but I bet I will. Charlotte, I think it's Nickdow. It's either Nickdow or Nickdeo. It's one or the other. She plays the chief designer, Poppy. David Hornsby is the poor, put-upon boss who never seems like he's ever really the boss at all. David. F. Murray Abraham shows up. He's like this sci-fi hack. I mean, writer. C.W. Longbottom. Danny Pudi's on the show. He basically plays the anti-Abed here as the monetization guy, Brad. These two young actresses, Ashley Burch and Imani Hakim, play the two young game testers, Rachel and Dana. And then we have Jesse Ennis, who is the borderline psychotic assistant to, I don't never know who she is the assistant to on this show, quite frankly. Her character's name is Joe. So the creators behind this one, again, McElhenney from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and Charlie Day, actually, from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. They're two of the co-creators here. And by the way, it's not really a spoiler to say this now. I was kind of shocked that Charlie Day did not show up even in a brief role at any point in seasons one or two. Unless I either blinked and missed him, or he was a voice somewhere that I didn't pick up on. I don't know. The third person in the creator mix here is Megan Ganz. She's been a writer and producer on It's Always Sunny for the past few years, but she also came from being a writer and producer on both Modern Family and Community. That's important. You'll see why the further I go on here. Now, the premise of this show, it's on one hand, it's basically a workplace comedy. The place where they work, it's the video game design company behind this worldwide phenomenon video game called Mythic Quest. But while the game is massively successful, the staff is more than a little dysfunctional. Now, the lineage of the series does inform it a lot. I mean, there is a little bit of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia sprinkled here and there. I mean, that's going to happen not only because you have Rob McElhenney as your main character and also one of the creators and writers of the show, but don't forget David Hornsby, who I mentioned. He's the guy who played Cricket on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where he was also a writer there as well. But beyond that connection, there is a definite, most definite community vibe to a lot of the goings-on on this show. Only maybe with less meta vibes than Community had. It's a show that the more you watch it, it becomes not just engaging, it gets kind of addictive. It does have that I gotta watch the next one kind of quality, which you don't always get with comedy series. But you do get that with shows like A Community and even Sunny in Philadelphia, and they pull it off here as well. So since we're going to start speaking of certain points, plot points, let's get into the spoiler zone here a little. So I can tell you about what I'm going to call some of the most truly extraordinary episodes of television that are not just perhaps the best episodes of any of the seven series I'm going to be discussing here. They are episodes that a couple of which I would say are among the best TV episodes, period, over the last few years. I'm talking like Teddy Perkins memorably good. That's how good we're talking here. Now, in season one, the first episode that really breaks the mold and then some is the fifth episode. It's called A Dark, Quiet Death. And one notable thing right off the bat about that episode, except for a brief moment at the very end, perhaps might even be a post-credit scene, I think. I can't remember. Does not feature any of the cast in it. Instead, it centers on characters played by Jake Johnson and Kristen Milioti as a couple. We see them meet, and we spend the next 20-something years of their lives watching how they create a video game and where that leads. And I'm not going to make it sound all that interesting, but it's an amazing episode. It's basically the beginning, middle, and end of a relationship, a love affair, an entrepreneurship. It's just, it's really something special. You can just watch that episode and not watch the show at all because it's separate from the show. It has very little to no connection to the show. It's very slight. It's something really special to see. Now, later in the season, I guess it was a 10-episode season. I think sometime around the 9th episode, I think they stopped for a while due to the COVID outbreak. And then they came back a few months later with what I'm going to say is the best quarantine episode of 2020. Because we know a bunch of shows did things along those lines. Even that whole Parks and Recreation reunion episode. Oh, by the way, that's another show that I feel Mythic Quest reminds me of a little bit. Parks and Recreation, it kind of falls into that category as well. So, which anyone who's a fan of that show, you know that's high praise. But they had this great quarantine episode, which was aptly titled simply Quarantine. It's so well done. You just have to see it. There's no point in my trying to describe it. It's literally they're dealing with the quarantine and all working from home and what ensues. It's just really well done. And then at the end of, I guess, season one, even though they waited almost a year to do the episode, they came back with this episode that felt like it was right out of the Community playbook, an episode titled Everlight, where everyone in the office basically takes cosplaying to a new level. The entire set is dressed to have this whole fantasy medieval kind of feel to it. It's very, very Community-like, which is so appropriate because the one person who's not into any of it, who hates all of it, is the actor from Community, Danny Pudi's character. Like I said, he's the anti-Abed and then some here. And that's a very deliberate choice on their part. But yeah, it's that episode, The Dark Quiet Death, that really came out of nowhere and really stands out. And then when you go to season two, you get another episode, which is almost like that. The sixth episode of that season, which was titled Backstory, which we do realize at a certain point is essentially the backstory of that writer, C.W. Longbottom. But it's an episode that takes place over the throughout the 1970s, and then eventually years later. It's just a shocking and surprising and well-constructed, head-snapping change of pace kind of episode. It's really, again, something really special. Watching these young trio of wannabe sci-fi writers working at this little minor Sci-Fi Digest kind of publication where it features acclaimed writers like Isaac Asimov and Ray Bradbury, you know, Robert Heinlein, those kind of Ursula Le Guin, those kind of writers who would get their stories published there on a regular basis. It's just really well done. Again, does not require any like name brand casting for the episode. It's just something special. And then it actually gets paid off in the very next episode, which does take place in present day. And it's an episode titled Peter, which focuses on, you know, the F. Murray Abraham character, as well as one of the young, game testers who's for some reason becomes his driver for the episode. And also William Hurt is in the episode, playing, well, the title character Peter, who we'd seen the younger version of in the previous episode. It actually occurred to me when I'm watching it, it's just these two actors going off on each other, that both these guys won Best Actor Oscars. I think it might have been back-to-back years, or if not back-to-back years, very close to it in the 1980s. Because I remember that F. Murray Abraham won Best Actor for Amadeus, and William Hurt won Best Actor for Kiss of the Spider-Woman. It might have been 84 and 85, but I could be wrong about that. I didn't look that up, but if I'm not wrong, I'm damn close. Let's leave it that way. Anyway, this was the show that really wowed me, especially that first season. And since I'll get to the ratings now, I'm telling you that first season, how good it is. I'm going to put it right there with Ted Lasso season one. That's how good I think the show is. I'm giving it 4.5 apples for that first season. The second season, I'm going to shave a little bit off that. Some of the storylines still worked, but they might have, let's say, stretched incredulously a little bit, or maybe went on a little bit longer than they should have here and there. I would still give it 4 apples. Because let me tell you something. I think of all 7 series, this is the one I'm most wondering about how they're going to pick up the pieces for season 3. Because by the end of season 2, it's kind of like they blow the whole damn thing up. But it's really highly recommended. Really good show. Damn good show. So that takes us to our next candidate on Apple TV. Candidate? Is that really the right phrase? It's not. But I'm tired. So Schmigadoon is the show we're going to be talking about here. Who's in Schmigadoon? You got your Keegan-Michael Key as Josh Skinner. You got your Cecily Strong. Hey, she does something other than SNL. She's Melissa Gimbel. Alan Cumming. Who doesn't love Alan Cumming? He's in this as Mayor Aloysius Menlove. It's all in the name, man. Kristen Chenoweth. Always love Kristen Chenoweth. She's Mildred Layton, and Fred Armisen is the Reverend Howard Layton. And throughout the course of the series, you'll also get appearances from people like Martin Short and Jane Krakowski. And you know what? I can't really list the entire cast. Let's move on. And the creators of this show, these two fellows, Ken Dario and Cinco Paul, their main writing and producing work before this was primarily animated films, but a lot of them, like all three Despicable Me movies, and The Secret Life of Pets, and Hop, and The Lorax, and Horton Hears a Who, you get the idea. I guess they just hadn't really done much in the way of live action, actual people. But here it is. But it's also a Lorne Michaels production, and you could pretty much guess as you're watching it, this show doesn't happen without him. But you know what? I could say that about a lot of television legacies and stars over the past 40 years, but I'm not here to defend Lorne Michaels. I'm here to talk about Schmigadoon. Now, the setup for the show is that Key and Strong, they're a couple who, let's say, they're having some issues. So what do? They decide to go on a, what do I call this? I don't know. I'm going to call it like a backpacking hike trip getaway, whatever. Basically in hopes of patching up those problems. I mean, that's her thinking. Maybe not so much his. What they don't foresee happening is that they're going to end up finding a magical little village hidden out in the woods somewhere where pretty much everyone acts and, of course, breaks out into song as though they were living in a classic musical. Oh, yeah. They also discover, once they're there, they can't leave. At least not until, well, that might be a little bit of a spoiler, so I'll keep mum on that for a minute or two. Now look, if you're not really a fan of musicals, and I mean classic musicals like, you know, The Music Man and Oklahoma and, well, Brigadoon, I mean, that's where they got the name from. And I'll be honest with you, those specific ones, especially those last two, they're not really my personal preference either when it comes to musicals from that era. This might not be the series for you, but two things. Number one, if you do like them, or if you could at least have an open mind about such things, which I do, you know what? You are going to enjoy the heck out of the show. I mean, hey, it's not perfect. I'll get into why in a sec, but it really doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to work, and I think it does. So on that note, and it's not a musical note because I ain't singing, let me get a little bit more spoilerific here so I can actually talk about the series with a little bit more depth. Now, look, they cast two very likable performers in Cecily Strong and Key there. But it's kind of funny to me that I don't actually find either of their characters to be really all that likable. Maybe that's why they cast them with those actors. But then again, I'm pretty sure this was a project that was always meant to be built around Cecily Strong from the get-go. You know, because at some points I questioned certain things. Like number one, how easily and quickly these two just abandon each other for pretty much any other possible loves that they literally just met, which is also, by the way, their way of being able to get out of that town. They have to be able to cross a bridge and get out of that town. They have to have found true love, which they apparently didn't have for each other, at least not when they first got there. But the whole business about just meeting someone and falling in love, which I was questioning, I kind of then realized they're in a world of a movie musical from a bygone era. These were movies or musicals when they were originally on Broadway before they were in the movies. Characters would fall in love with each other after just one song, a little tappity-tap-tap, boom, 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 they're in love. So I went, okay, that's kind of the conceit they're going with here. So I can buy that. I'll let it go. In fact, there's a lot of things you just have to buy and let go because it's just, it's not meant to be that heavy a show. It's a comedy. It's a musical. It's light. It's silly. So you might find yourself wondering about how insulated are these people from the outside world? Are they aware of an outside world at all? Where does their food come from? Is there a farm somewhere? Do meat and vegetables just magically appear in their refrigerators or in the general store or something? What year do they think it is? Just how old-timey is this place? Because the phones don't look like they're all that old, but you don't get the impression anyone's ever seen a car before. I don't know. We'll never know. So we move on. Back to the cast. Look, the big thing in the cast for me, it's seeing Kristen Chenoweth. I think Kristen Chenoweth is a dynamo. She can pretty much do no wrong. She's an extraordinary talent, especially when it comes to musical theater. I love the fact she's playing a villain because, and I'm sure she has done that before because I can't rattle off her roles. I didn't look her up on IMDb, but I have seen her in a number of things over the years. I've never actually had the privilege of seeing her on stage, but I know she's been in many, many things over the years. But she's always such a effervescent, positive, you know, smiling presence. So for her to play the town sourpuss, marm, villain, nasty piece of work, I thought was just a lovely piece of, you know, reverse casting. I got a huge kick out of it. That's pretty much the way I felt about the series overall. I mean, at the end of the day, it was light. It was fun. It wasn't very long. It's not very long at all. The episodes themselves are not long. It's not that many episodes. I think it's, I didn't write it down. How many episodes did I watch? Was it six episodes? I feel like it was a six episode season. Pretty embarrassed if I forgot that. So it's good. Is it great? I don't want to say great. I'm not going to say great. Some of the songs are memorable. Some, they're okay. It could be better. But then again, it's also because they're also mining musicals that I don't love as much as others. I mean, if you're going to ask me about musicals that I love, number one, they usually have to have Gene Kelly in them. So, you know, if you're not, they may be, someone may be watching Singing in the Rain at one point in it, but they don't, you know, there's no songs in this piece that are as good as anything from Singing in the Rain. Let's put it that way. Not that there could be, because come on. Singing the Rain. So let me wrap it up with a rating. I'm going to give it 3.5 apples. It's not 4, but it feels like it's a little better than 3. And I'm not going to start using quarters because that's ridiculous. So 3.5 apples. Okay. Oof. I am tired, but we've got more to go. Oh boy. Here we go. Oh boy. Because the next one is Invasion. Yeah, Invasion. Okay, so the people behind Invasion, the creators, if you will. First, it's Simon Kinberg. He's a guy I think of as being, he's basically the main guy doing almost all the Marvel stuff that isn't part of Kevin Feige's MCU over the past 15 years. So he's behind several of the X-Men movies, the Deadpool movies, Legion, Logan. Ooh, Legion, that's really good, whatever. And the other guy, the other creator on the show is David Wheel. Hasn't done quite as much as Kinberg, which is understandable. But he's behind two Amazon Prime series, Solos and Hunters. I've never seen Solos. I'm familiar with it. I've heard of it. I know who, I was like, oh, that's the one that Morgan Freeman and all these other people were in, whatever. But I definitely have seen Hunters. I think we're going to get a second season of Hunters next year, if I'm not mistaken. Great show with a dumb final episode, but we'll see how they do the second season. So there you go. Those are the people behind the show. Now, as I had done with all the other shows, I would have mentioned the cast, giving you 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever number of names. With this one, I got to say, with one exception, it's actually very cool that it's not a star-filled cast by any stretch of the imagination. It's a very diverse cast, which makes sense because the storylines, at least initially, I think they take place on 4 or maybe 5 different continents, at least at the very start. A lot of the names in the cast, therefore, they're they're Japanese, they're Middle Eastern, that could be, you know, either it's Farsi or Iraqi or Iranian, whatever. I am unfortunately become known for my talent for mispronouncing names on this podcast. And I can tell you, I looked over the list of names. I would absolutely butcher, if not every single name in this cast, the vast majority of them, pretty much anyone who's not named Sam Neill, I'm going to screw up their name. So I'm not going to disrespect these performers and embarrass myself by going any further down that line. So I'll just move on to what the setup of the show is, or what it's supposed to be. Huh. Well, the show Invasion, hey, you know what it's supposed to be? It's about an alien invasion. And we're supposed to follow the trials and tribulations. Why do I love that phrase? Of essentially, or at least initially, five characters and, you know, the people around them and how this invasion affects and impacts each one of them. Okay, so look, there's a lot to like here. I mean, it looks good, and most of the actors are quite good, or, okay, maybe the majority of them are, I don't know. What else? There's a couple cool songs they licensed that are used throughout the series, but look, let's get real. I personally, generally speaking, I do not mind a slow burn when you're telling a story. I have patience. I have more patience than most, quite frankly, especially when I feel that a lot of time and care is being taken for setting up the plots, the characters, the overall world building. But this series, oh man, I'm going to tell you something. I can honestly say that the only reason I stuck with this thing for all 10 episodes was because I had already decided I was going to be reviewing it for this podcast. And if I'm going to do that, I got to watch the whole damn thing. Otherwise, I'll be straight up honest, like I just said, I would have bailed on this one before I even hit the midway mark of this series. So at this point, there's no way I can dissect or shred this or whatever without spoiling it. So boom, spoiler shackles are officially off. Let me get into what is so wrong here. First of all, it feels like we don't even get anything feeling all that invasion-y for I don't know how long until maybe the sixth episode. You know, like actually encountering any extraterrestrial invaders. I mean, yes, there's a blink in that moment that you might have missed it in the Afghani desert earlier on. But come on, lame. And when they do get to that sixth episode, what do they give us? It's basically A Quiet Place warmed over. So, bleh. Second, I said we were following five storylines, you know, based mainly around five characters. Let's go through them. So, number one, you get the guy in Afghanistan, the soldier, Cole. His storyline, for the most part, is just, it's actually unexpectedly repetitive and even kind of boring until he gets to London. And then, well, we'll get to that. Then we have the woman who works at the Japanese space agency, Mitsuki. Okay, first of all, is there any chemistry whatsoever between her and her astronaut lover? I mean, there is literally no spark whatsoever. And I may want to apply it to her performance as well. I mean, it's just, ugh. And quite frankly, the show is kind of ruined a little bit because having watched For All Mankind a week or so earlier, nothing about the space agency stuff in this series feels remotely real to me at all. It just feels either unbelievable or just really bland. So then you have the situation with the Middle Eastern family that's in Long Island. And the focal character there is the mom, Anisha Malik. Okay, that one's not bad per se. Although I kind of wanted to suffocate either one kid or the other at different times watching them. And yes, the husband's a total piece of shit. Yeah, we get it. And he is, absolutely. But oh my God, there are so many things I felt they never really explored or answered throughout the entire season with these people, especially regarding her son, you know, the one who didn't get a nosebleed unlike everybody else in his class, or that weird piece of black kryptonite or whatever that stupid alloy fragment thing that they found. And what I just found it really frustrating, but frustrating is the word for this series. Then you've got the kids in London, which for a good chunk of time takes on a total Lord of the Flies kind of vibe. And I'll tell you something. That was the storyline that actually did hold my interest. That was the one that got even more strange and mysterious as it went along. And they actually, that storyline actually intersects with the Soldier Boy, Cole, there in London. That one I did like. I was found it compelling. I was into that one. So that sounds like it's it. But wait, I said five storylines. That's just four. What's going on here? Oh, yeah. You know what they did? They set us up in the first episode to think that Sam Neill's storyline, he's this dude, he's a retiring sheriff in some small Oklahoma town. You get the impression this is going to be one of those threads we're going to be following for the entire series. That's how they promoted it. He's the most prominent actor in all the ads for this show. And that's the character I think that we're all most immediately invested in from the get-go, far more than any of the others. And guess what? He's only in the first episode. That's it. No more Oklahoma, no more Sam Neill. The little mysterious thing happens at the end of the episode. It's never, ever addressed ever again. And then you're left with nine episodes with only really one compelling story, you know, with those poor kids in London. And this series, which takes forever and ever and ever and ever, what the seeming resolution, or I guess the false resolution when it happens, it happens so ridiculously fast to the point of you're just confused. Like, wait, what just happened? It's over. What? And part of that is because it feels like we never get the remotest details about these supposed alien invaders. Although we do get to see them. And I kind of got a kick of how they realize it's different. But there's so much we don't know. And I kept thinking we would know more than we seem to here. I mean, I get it. They knocked out all the satellites around the world. Got it. But you know what? There are telescopes and observatories all around the world that are working. And we don't have any sense of their ships. We have to track this. I was so frustrated. It was, ugh. And then I hear they've actually renewed this thing for a second season. Are you kidding me? Really? Ugh. I don't even want to talk about it anymore. I don't have the energy. I'm feeling the COVID coming back just thinking about it. Ugh, invasion. Ugh. So I would give it, I'll give it one apple. Ugh. And there's like a half a worm in that apple too. Awful. And that brings us to the last series I watched. Just finished it 24 hours ago, 36 hours ago. Don't remember. That would be The Shrink Next Door. That's the one that stars Will Ferrell as Marty Markowitz. And for my fellow New Yorkers, it's not the Brooklyn Borough President from years ago. It's a totally different character. And Paul Rudd playing Dr. Ike or Dr. Isaac Hirschkopf. And also Kat, you know, people love her, especially after her stint as Agatha in WandaVision. Should mention Katherine Hahn is Phyllis Shapiro, who is Marty's sister, and Casey Wilson is Bonnie Hirschkopf, who is Dr. Ike's wife. The creator of this series is Georgia Pritchett. Georgia Pritchett has a really, really impressive resume she can trot out, because she was a writer and producer on Veep and a writer and producer on Succession. What else do you need? To me, that's already a big, super big wow. Because you've got one of the best comedies in years. And guess what? And you guys will hear it when I get to that best of 2021 at some point next month. One of the best drama series in years. So the idea for this limited series, because there ain't going to be a season two, it actually came from a true crime podcast. So yes, there actually was a Marty Markowitz and a Dr. Ike Hirschkopf. They are real people. And I just realized I haven't even given you what the premise is of this show. Basically, the series is about an anxiety-ridden guy named Marty who starts seeing a psychiatrist, and we soon see and learn that Dr. Ike's methods and motivations, they may not be the healthiest therapy for Marty. Let's put it that way. Now, of all seven series that I'm yapping about on this podcast, and by the way, look how fast I'm going through. It's amazing. It's always easy when you don't have to let anyone else talk, which I hardly seem to do anyway. Of all seven shows I've been talking about, I'll be honest right now, this is the toughest one for me to really render a verdict on. Oh, and the last episode of the series is titled The Verdict. That's weird. Anyway, so you're kind of wondering, what are you talking about? Why? I'll get to that eventually. One of the first things that hits you when you're watching this show, and you might have even picked up on it if you've seen the ads for it, is that you're watching Farrell and Rudd play these, how shall I say this? You know what? I can say it. They're playing very Jewish guys. Now, there may be some who will watch this and think at times maybe they lapse into caricature here and there. I personally am not so sure I would say that. Because if you can ask anyone who's Jewish, especially New York Jewish, and especially if you've hung out with Long Island Jews, and I'm talking about the ones with serious money, the six-figure bar mitzvah types, and so on, no, they're not that different. And a lot of it's like, oh, how they speak and the way they you know what? It's a Jewish thing to actually talk that way. You know, that the very sing-song cadence, it's what a lot of my people do. It's the way they talk. Trust me, it happens. You people have seen Seinfeld. You've seen a few of them. Anyway. Now, there are some who might say, hey, why wouldn't they have just hired two Jewish actors for these parts instead? Okay. Now, after I repair the vein that just exploded in my head when I've heard that sentiment come up, it's a perspective that seems to have been arising more and more over the last few years. It's kind of starting to infuriate me. It's kind of starting to piss me off. Because look, I'm sorry. I love her to death, but I'm not Sarah Silverman here decrying that there aren't enough Jewish women getting Jewish roles. And I'm not one of those people who got upset that a Spaniard like Javier Bardem got the gig playing a Cuban Ricky Ricardo. Enough, you people. You're embarrassing us all now. Because when you start using that kind of standard, hey, you know what? You're basically saying Meryl Streep should never have learned an accent because she never should have played a Polish Jew or a South African or an Italian or a Brit or pretty much the majority of all of her roles. It's called acting, people. You need to shut the fuck up about the majority of these complaints. Now, to be clear, I'm not talking about issues of actual race or gender here. So this is not talking about, you know, there not being enough Asian representation or black representation. That's a different issue. That is not what I mean. But when you're talking about, oh, so-and-so, why wouldn't you get so-and-so to be that because they're already that? It's like, no, that's not how acting works. So, complaints like in these areas can often be valid, but you gotta draw a line when it lapses into silliness. So just stop. And guess what? The people who say these things, and they're talking about this series specifically, you're right. Will Ferrell, he is not a member of the tribe. But you know what? Paul Rudd certainly is. He's a full-blown Jew. We're not talking about some Hanukkah song fraction. I mean, the dude had a bar mitzvah, and he even DJed at bar mitzvahs for years. So, look, I'm not saying that either Rudd or Ferrell should be dusting off shelf space for any awards anytime soon. I'm not saying that they're quite that good. But they are both playing against type, which is commendable. And they're two very watchable actors, which is why you cast them in these roles. Because for a story like this, you're gonna need that, because trust me, it's a little trying otherwise. Oh, and just to finish my point, you know, just to finish up the Jew thing, shall we say, Catherine Hahn, who herself has played several Jewish roles throughout her career, she played that Lily Lebowski on Crossing Jordan. She was the female rabbi on Transparent. And here she's Phyllis, Marty's sister. And there's also characters that were not specifically Jewish, but you kind of got the impression they might have been. Catherine Hahn may be a lot of things. She may even not be beloved after her Agatha role on WandaVision. There's one thing she is not, and that's Jewish. She's not even 1% Jewish. She's a Catholic, people. All right, so let's start getting a little bit more in depth here so I can really get into my issues, you know, what I like and what I don't about this series so we can then figure out how the hell I'm going to rate it. Spoiler section. Okay, look, the problem with the show, let's just get into it right off the bat. It's 8 episodes, which covers the course of over 30 years. I mean, actually, honestly, by the time it's actually over, it's almost 40 years that it technically covers. And the problem is the whole thing feels like it was twice as long as it needed to be. For a really long stretch of this series, it's really just not much fun to watch because Marty is just manipulated and used over and over, episode after episode after episode. I get it. I understand that this really happened. But good Lord, could this not have been pared down to, I don't know, if not a movie, if you felt it needed to breathe more than just, you know, a movie, although honestly, it could have been a movie, then maybe just make it like a two-part series. Two-part series. Cut down the time here. Because yes, it is satisfying when Marty finally stands up to Dr. Ike after, at that point, I guess 28 years. But that's after 7 episodes. Oh my God. It's, I'm not going to say it's torture. That's an extreme way to put it. But it's just, you'd have that kind of feeling watching it. Ugh. Because it's hard not to, again, here, oh, hey, like Invasion, frustrated. Love that word. It's hard not to get completely frustrated to the point of actually being angry at Marty. Because you're thinking, oh, dude, how can you be so gullible, so brainwashed for so long? How can you throw away your family for nearly 30 years? Not to mention everything that's going down and going wrong at your own company. And I understand, again, as I said moments ago, it's a true story. They're playing it like it happened, apparently. But really, having to watch this episode after episode, oy vey, indeed. Oish. And oh, by the way, Dr. Ike's wife, Bonnie, she is at the very least complicit in all of this. The fact she has a few moments of questioning things over the course of, yeah, over 30 years is way too little, always too late. She should be, yeah, burned just the way Dr. Ike should be burned for this. So yeah, I am left kind of puzzled about this one. Now, I know I just said a bunch of negative things. I should say there's a lot to like. It's very New York. So I kind of love that. But on the other hand, it felt a little forced New York. As opposed to something like, say Only Murders in the Building, which really had the feel and vibe of at least that part of New York City that made New York feel like another character in it entirely. This, I don't know if they really pulled that off as much. Plus, they spend a heck of a lot of time in the Hamptons, and good Lord. You know, at the end of the day, it's like I said, those two actors make it very watchable. I admire that they even did this at all. There is a lot to like. I just think there's too much of it. I think I would have liked it to have been pared down, honed down into something that might have just been, and maybe would have had more of an impact, or just not felt quite as torturous. I'm probably making it sound a lot more negative than I should. So, but again, how do I rate this? If I split the difference and only gave it 2.5 apples, or it should be 2.5 helpings of applesauce, you know, with the potato pancakes, that feels a little harsh because that would be rating it the way I rated, what did I do that with? Second season of morning show. I think it's a little better than that. I didn't have that as much of an issue. So I'm going to give it three. I'm going to give it three apples. All right. So basically, I'm going to say it's recommended, but with reservations, if that makes any sense. It's just, I would recommend it to someone. I would just let them know it may feel a little long. It may feel like it's not as much fun as you're expecting it to be, considering it's Rudd and Ferrell. It doesn't mean it's bad. It may feel a little long. I mean, it's eight episodes of this. Ugh. Okay. All right. Holy crap. Did I just do all that in like an hour and 20? Nice. So let me start wrapping things up here. If you enjoyed this podcast, I hope you did. Guess what? You'll probably enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page where you can talk about shows like all seven that I just mentioned and probably 700 other shows. Whatever you want to talk about there, you're more than welcome to strike up a chat, put up a thread, and talk to us about it. Now, as far as where you can find the podcast, you can pretty much find it everywhere that podcasts are made available. Your Spotify, your Amazon Music, your Apple Podcasts, and so on. But better still, you can go to stvdpodcast.podbean.com, where you can find all 329. I couldn't have made it to 330 by the end of the year. Oh, that's really bad. That deserves a. Anyway, so. You can also follow us on Instagram. I wish somebody would, but then again, I did neglect the account for a few weeks there, but I just posted a bunch of things. Apparently, I don't know how to post links to our podcast there, as one of my friends and listeners actually pointed out to me, because I'm an idiot, but hopefully maybe someone can show me how to do that. But anyway, you're following us there for the pictures anyway. Instagram, our handle there is Serious TV Drama, all is one word. Better still, follow us on Twitter. Why wouldn't you follow us on Twitter? Come on. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama. Now, we will be back in 2022. I foresee a few podcasts in January. We should get at least one, if not two, Breaking Bad rewatches. To done there. We have to finish up season four. That should be an amazing podcast because those are amazing episodes. And we might be able to break ground on season five in January. I mentioned before, I might be changing the format of how I talk about the show slightly. We'll see when we get there. What else in January? Hopefully at some point I'll get to eventually wrap with Brian about the rest of Doom Patrol. Maybe we might combine it with something else that we want to talk about. Who knows? And as I also mentioned earlier on this podcast, there will definitely be a best of 2021 podcast. It's just a matter of me talking with, I don't know if it's going to be Brian, Jamie, and Dan all participating. I think they will. Just got to determine how we're going to approach it. Either we're just going to do, each of us will do one list each. Either we'll do two lists each. I kind of want to make it as simple and accessible and fun for everyone as possible. So we'll see. We shall see, but hopefully we'll get to that by mid-January. So that's it. So to you guys out there, thank you for listening to us all year. I know it's been a hard, well, not just a hard year, it's been a hard 2 years now, but hopefully 2022 works out better for all of us. So with that, have a happy new year, and we will see you on the other side.